everybody. Welcome to the ProGov Podcast, a monthly podcast exploring policies and tools for progressive local governance with leaders from policy research institutes around the U.S. The ProGov Podcast is brought to you by ProGov21.org, a free resource and public good for local legislators, policymakers, and advocates. ProGov21 is a fully searchable digital archive of thousands of progressive local and state policies and tools for their effective use. I'm your host, Ada Inman, and today we are joined by Wanzi Maruvi and Annie Dade of the Center for the Study of Child Care Employment for a great discussion around fair compensation and support for the early care and education workforce. Wanzi and Annie, thank you both so much for joining me today. Wanzi, as the Center for the Study of Child Care Employment, or CSCCE's Senior Research and Policy Associate, you have ample experience in policy and planning within the early childhood education and care sector. Similarly, Annie, as CSCCE's Project Policy Analyst, you have lots of experience in education and policy. Can you each tell me a little bit about your career trajectory and how you got to where you are today? Wanzi, would you like to start?
Sure. I grew up in a rural village in Zimbabwe where everybody's livelihood depended on farming. And my parents were poor farmers, just like everybody in the village. So this inspired me to pursue an educational training and a career in agriculture. And I actually believed then that with better knowledge of farming methods, we could be able to lift everybody out of poverty, would increase the villagers' productivity, make them more productive farmers. But despite, like, it was not just me, even all the other people I grew up with, there was a lot of people going to train because agriculture was really important where I came from. But I quickly realized that my parents continued to struggle. They continued to be poor farmers, just like the rest of the villagers. They struggled with many aspects. They were very knowledgeable farmers. That's what I realized. But they had problems with access to inputs. They suffered from droughts, and recovery from it was a challenge. When they took their produce to markets, the prices were never enough to make them live by. So I quickly realized that knowledge of farming alone and farming skills was not enough to lift these people out of poverty. They needed more than that. They needed supportive policies and supports and resources that will allow them to actually do the jobs that they knew how to do the best and feed the nation. So I decided to go back to school and thought, I think there's something I'm missing. So I enrolled in school and I did another degree in the social sciences where I learned about research and how to make policies. I hoped I would learn to make good policies. And so after I graduated, I got a job in Canada. That's where I first had my job in the early childhood sector. I first worked for the United Way before I moved on to a municipal government, which in Canada, or in Ontario where I was, they have the responsibility for planning and a local service system managed for early childhood education services. And then eventually from that municipal government, I moved to the center. So I was really excited to the Center for the Study of Childcare Employment. But you might wonder, what has early childhood education got to do with farming, Wanzi? But I hope you can see the parallels that just like farmers, I think early childhood educators are some of the most unsung heroes. The little village farmers that I'm talking about fed the nation. Early childhood educators raised our most important scholars in our life because they become our future. And just like farmers, early childhood educators need supportive policies for them to do the jobs that they know how to do best. So I think that the challenges that are facing the early childhood educator today, the chronic staffing shortages, the high staff turnover, and the related challenges to childcare availability are not because of lack of knowledge and skills among the educators. It is because there is a deficit in the policy environment that allows them to be the best of whom they can be, the best educators of some of our youngest citizens. So I was very excited when I got the opportunity to join the Center for the Study of Childcare Employment because I think the work that they do is really at the root of ensuring that this really valuable resource we have, who care for some of our most valuable citizens in our society, have the supports and resources they need to do their jobs well. I'll hand it over to Annie. So that's sort of me in a nutshell.
Thanks, Wanzi. So I started my career in the classroom, And I taught for a few years, both in a classroom and outdoor education and an after-school program, and students ranging all the way from kindergarten to adults. And I really liked being in a program setting, but I realized that my favorite part of the work was actually collaborating with the students, and particularly adult students, around designing programs to better suit their needs and their goals. And I was also coming to understand that the issues of our education and care systems, kind of like what Wansi was talking about, they're not problems that reside in the individuals in the systems, but really in the policies that create them and the inequities that they're really designed to bring about. So I went back to grad school. I got my master's in public policy at UC Berkeley, and I was really focusing on education and care systems and drawn to policy research projects that were grounded in principles of participatory design and community-based research. And while I was at Berkeley, I, you know, found the center, CSCCE, started working with them as a grad student. And I was so excited to be working in a policy research setting that prioritized this kind of scholar activism and, you know, shared my commitment to social policy as a tool for racial and gender equity. And CSCCE really understands that childcare in our early childhood sector really sits at the nexus of those things.
Can you please tell me about the Center for the Study of Childcare Employment and the work that you do?
The work of the Center for the Study of Childcare Employment is really at the core of addressing the key workforce challenges that are facing this sector right now. I think I can sum it by saying that we provide research and analysis on the preparation, working conditions, and compensation of the early care and education workforce. We are going to be referring to this workforce as early care and education staff. Sometimes we might call them childcare workers. But it is the same workforce that looks for, like, the focus is on providing early childhood education and care for some of our very young learners. We also develop policy solutions and we create spaces for teaching, learning, and educator activism. I'll let Annie elaborate a little more on the work of the center.
Yeah, thanks, Wansi. So our policy research, as Wansi was talking about, is really grounded in a history of educator and worker-led activism since the 90s, and the Worthy Wage campaign was co-led by our director emerita, Dr. Marcy Whitebook. And anytime now you hear a statistic about the early care and education workforce, it often comes from us. Our data and policy analysis were included in Biden's Build Back Better proposal in a recent Treasury report. Just this week, Dr. Whitebook delivered remarks in the opening plenary of the ACF National Research Conference. And our executive director, Dr. Leah Austin, provided testimonial at a congressional hearing on childcare and the pandemic recovery. So we really do try and make sure that the research that we're doing is meaningful to the national policy conversation. But, you know, especially given that there is so much stalling at the federal level around childcare, we really also focus on our work with states. And our research staff are regularly called upon to provide TA to states. We conduct our own state-level research in the Workforce Index, which we put out around every 2 years. We're also working with 7 states in a Bold on Compensation learning community, specifically around early education compensation. And we have a database that collects strategies for compensation across states, tribes, and territories. So those are just a few of the examples of the ways that we're trying to really speak to the policy conversation around early childhood educators.
I will just add on to what Annie has said regarding some of the work we are doing. I want to give a California example. For example, in California, our research staff are paying very close attention to the transitional kindergarten expansion policy, and will continue to provide data analysis and recommendations as needed to ensure that this really important early learning provision works well, not just for the children and the families, but for the educators as well. For those who are not familiar, transitional kindergarten, or TK, is a school-based early learning program for 4-year-olds that is being rolled out in California and will have full implementation in 2025. And there are 2 really important points that I want to highlight regarding this really important work that the staff are doing. First, we want to ensure that the highly skilled and experienced pool of early educators that are already existing, that are already working with children birth up to 5 years, have a fair pathway and opportunity to these TK jobs, because we know that these TK jobs are better, provide better wages, and have better benefits. So as the policy for TK expansion is being crafted and the TK is being rolled out, we are constantly looking at how best the policies can ensure that the existing pool of educators can also have pathways to these really good jobs. The second one is probably trying to highlight the obvious. TK expansion is really still part of the early care and learning sector, because it's an early learning provision. And it is happening in the context of a sector that already has a workforce shortage. So we just want to point out that without careful consideration, TK expansion may exacerbate the chronic shortage of the early care workforce that already exists. So that's a really important policy point and policy decision that we would like the decision makers to always be very clear that the sector has a workforce shortage and we need educators to be able to teach the TK students.
Are there any new policies or reports that our listeners should keep an eye out for?
Yeah, so I would say for folks working at the state, tribe, or territory level, either in an agency, staff, or advocacy position, and they're interested in early childhood educator compensation, we are building out a compensation strategies database where you can go and filter, you know, by state or by a particular strategy, whether it's a tax credit or some kind of grant. And so we're building that out continuously as we get entries, and it's available on our website. We also have a Bold on Compensation learning community where we dive deeper with just 7 states and have discussions about, you know, increasing wages and benefits and empowering early educators in the compensation policy conversation, things like that. And we will be putting out resources on our website around those conversations, including some blog posts, which will be coming out this summer. And what may be of interest to some of your listeners is that Wisconsin is one of our learning community states. And so we know from working with them in the learning community and also entries in our database that they have employed multiple strategies, right, for addressing early childhood compensation. So you can look out for more details for that online.
I just want to add on to that and say that some of your listeners might be familiar with some of the reports that we've released from the data we collected as part of our 2020 California Early Care and Education Workforce Study. This study was actually conducted about 8 or so months after the onset of the pandemic, and we managed to survey over 7,000 educators. So we've been continuing to release a lot of products. I think people might be aware of the COVID impact reports we produced, reports on workforce, economic well-being, etc. But I just wanted to sort of go back again to that TK conversation I was talking about, because we also did some analysis using this workforce study data. And what we did was we found that actually the existing pool of early childhood educators, quite a number of them would meet the rigorous requirements that would allow them to teach in a TK classroom. For example, at the moment, there is a credential that has been proposed that would allow people to teach in a TK classroom. So we said, okay, suppose early educators were required to have a bachelor degree, a child development permit at the teacher level or higher, and if they had to have an experience of 6 years or more teaching in an early childhood education, how many educators do we actually have right now who would meet this really rigorous requirement? And we found that almost 17,000 of existing educators in California would be able to qualify and actually teach a TK classroom. So that's really important for us. And not only that, again, to my point earlier, that TK jobs offer an opportunity to educators to jobs that pay better and have better benefits. And in our analysis, we said, well, if these teachers were to be paid at the same level as the current TK-12 teachers are being paid, they would actually, center teachers would stand to double their annual salaries, and family childcare providers would stand to earn 2.5 times more than they actually make. And this is no small feat. It's like an additional $40,000 to your annual salary a year. So we are really excited and hope that this is a way to show that there is a way to compensate educators that is better. And we also want our educators to have an opportunity to access these good paying jobs. So that's some of the work we have been doing with the workforce study data. We still have lots of data that hasn't been analyzed yet. So your listeners can stay tuned and look forward to more products from our workforce study data analysis. I also wanted to do a shout out to one of our projects that is about to be launched very, very soon. It's called the ECHOS. And ECHOS stands for Early Childhood History Organizing Ethos and Strategy. It is a project of the Center for the Study of Childcare Employment that explores the history of inequities within early childhood education and care and the roots of teacher activism for a more just system. So this is a really, really exciting project for us. And I hope we will be able to touch into some of the aspects that are related to this activism and the issues of inequity in the work that we do.
So I want to transition into some more policy-focused questions. So could you start by explaining at a very 10,000-foot level how different levels of government, meaning federal, state, and local, interact with the early care and education system?
So our early education system is really known for its incredibly complex, braided funding streams, and it's largely market-based as an industry. So it's really based on families' ability to pay, which I know Wanzi will talk a bit more about the policy implications of that. There is some public funding, however. At the federal level, we have funding through the CCDBG, which is a block grant to states, and that's for childcare subsidies, which really cover a child based on their family's income eligibility and means testing. And we have some direct program funding at the federal level, like for Head Start. And then, of course, during COVID, we saw federal relief funds that were passed. But again, those are time limited and certainly not enough to create any kind of universal coverage of the system. There are some state revenue, you know, that is allocated towards childcare, sometimes through taxation or a leasing revenue. And that might go towards the state subsidy system, or it might go towards direct programming, like a state preschool program, for example. And then maybe there's local funding, but more than likely, it'll be sort of local planning or agencies that connect families to providers in a given area, things like that. But the crux of the issue is really there is not enough public funding currently to cover all eligible children. And, you know, over half of centers don't receive any public funding. And even if the voucher system or subsidy system, sometimes as it's called, gets more funding, it's just not a sensible way to cover the cost of childcare, given that the labor cost is one of the highest drivers. So we really need a funding mechanism that supports program stability, like direct contracts and grants. And those targeted funds could then be used to improve wages, improve benefits and working conditions. Another lever for government to think about for improvement is data collection around the workforce and really engaging in comprehensive data systems so that the decisions they're making are evidence-based and disaggregated by race and ethnicity. So we're understanding how racism is shaping the field and not based on deficit-based assumptions about what the workforce might look like. And then another area for improvement that we are thinking about at the center as well is exploring the role of government in supporting general labor protections and protecting workers' rights to unionization. And this is definitely a challenge in early childhood. The system is very fragmented, but research shows that workers in analogous sectors like maybe nursing or home-based care will have better wages and working conditions when unionized. So I think it's definitely something that local governments can be looking into, is like how to set a political environment for unionization and childcare workers' protections.
If I can just add on to that, I think another area that the state can especially play an important role in supporting educators is trying to reduce the barriers to entry into the ECE field. We know that it really costs educators a lot of money, sometimes even before they set foot into the classroom. So we think that states especially can provide tuition reimbursement for ECE courses and materials, because it does cost them money to be able to acquire that, and also to eliminate the high cost of acquiring teacher permits, those conditions that the requirements that they have to meet to be able to continue teaching. And not sometimes it's not just about acquiring the permit, it's also renewing it afterwards. And this is an already like really poorly paid workforce. Having to pay a fee for something at any dollar is really a tax on an already under-resourced, like poorly resourced workforce that can barely make ends meet in terms of basic needs. So I think there's room for improvement in terms of just reducing the barriers. Another important point related to these barriers is that usually the minority groups, especially women of color, tend to be disproportionately impacted by some of the barriers to entry into the system. So I think that there is room, especially combined with the data systems that Annie pointed out, to really see where the need is and be able to really sort of strategically target these resources to ensure that everybody has a fair chance and stand a good chance to prosper in the professions that they really love and like to do.
Great. Thank you both. And thank you for touching on what local governments can do as well. I know so often the big overhanging issue is a lack of public funding. That's mostly going to be coming from the federal level. So it's nice to hear too what local governments can do just to help support the workforce and do their part as well. So moving on, childcare in the U.S. is extremely expensive, as you know, but ECE workers are underpaid. Why is this?
I think the truth of the matter is that the challenge faced by the system really stems in part, or maybe largely, from viewing early care and education as a market. Early childhood education and care is not amenable to the ways of the market the true value of early childhood education and care is not reflected in the way that childcare workers are paid, and it's not reflected in the fees that parents are paying. Yes, childcare is very expensive, and parents are paying a lot of money, often more than their mortgages or even university tuition. That is a fact that is well known. And yet, even the high fees that parents are paying are not covering the true cost of operating a high-quality childcare. Educators are still paid poverty wages. The childcare system is only viable because it relies on undervaluing and underpaying the workforce, who, by the way, are still providing a very high quality product in terms of the early childhood education and care service they are providing to the children and the families. So childcare workers cannot be faulted for leaving the profession and taking up retail and service jobs at Target and Starbucks, where they are being enticed with better wages and benefits. We are seeing this in especially some of our workforce study data from California, that it's really a choice between meeting some of the most basic needs of food on the table, roof over their head, and being able to access healthcare when they need it, versus fulfilling their professional dream. It's a really hard choice they have to make, and they make it every day. And some of them, like, they are operating really, like, it's unbelievable the way early childhood educators have to make it work to be able to serve children and families and still be professionals who do their work with all their hearts. Like, they basically pour their hearts. But it is a sector that runs at the back of early childhood educators. It is super subsidized by early childhood educators and sometimes by early childhood educators' families, because a lot of them were telling us that on their own, they cannot afford to live on their own. Their cost of living is really subsidized either by their partners or by their parents or by having to find a roommate. They cannot afford to live on their own. So I think the economics of the business, the problem is that the real value of early care and education can never be met by viewing it as part of a market system. It needs to be viewed as a public good that it is, just like the rest of the education system.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that. I think an important piece of the economics of childcare conversation is, as Wanzi pointed out, this system is essentially being subsidized by the workforce, who are then shouldering the true cost in poverty level wages. And the roots of this system in the US can really be traced to the historical enslavement of Black women and people in the US who, in many cases, were forced to care for children in white families as domestic workers. And this exploited labor then lays the foundation for the system we have today, in which care and education labor and the labor predominantly done by women and specifically women of color is undervalued. And then that in turn subsidizes economic gains made by others, often white households.
Thank you. So what happened to childcare and its workforce when COVID hit? And what does COVID mean today for the industry?
I think I'll take off by trying to say what really happened when COVID hit. Well, I think what you can say is that the pandemic only exacerbated a wound that was already festering. It has been festering for decades and will likely continue unless adequate and sustainable public investments are made. And unless childcare is viewed as the public good that it is, which I think I might sound like a broken record, but it really is a public good. And as an essential part of the public infrastructure needed to drive our economy and enhance our children's development, early childhood education or childcare or early care and education, whichever way we want to describe, it's really essential. It is essential for the economy. I think, fortunately, the only, I think, positive thing that COVID probably really helped to highlight is the fact that it is really an essential. It's like it forms the fabric, the foundation of our economies, because we couldn't do without childcare, even at the peak of COVID, which is really amazing. Just like roads, just like bridges, just like schools, just like libraries, just like parks. We view these things as public goods. Early childhood education and care needs to be viewed the same way. And I think the pandemic sort of brought that to light. Anyways, I think I would sum it by saying that COVID sent a sector that was already in crisis into critical mode. It's like, bring the defibrillators here. It already was like on its knees, and the pandemic just made it. It made it clear almost to everybody. While K-12 classrooms were closing down in February, March 2020, and to protect the staff and the children who work in the K-12 system, we know that many childcare programs stayed open. many childcare workers worked to save children of essential workers, and it took a long time for them to get adequate supports and protections. We know that the school system was operating very different from the way childcare was being treated. And unfortunately, as parents stayed home, enrollment in some of these childcare programs dropped. And like we said, because it's viewed as a market, right, supply and demand, the result was that educators were furloughed or were laid off because there were just not enough children in the room. So we had like a significant drop in childcare jobs since February 2020. And right now we are still 11% short of the jobs that we had in the childcare sector in February 2020. And recovery of childcare jobs has been much slower compared to other sectors in the economy. Other sectors are very close to 100% recovery now. Childcare is still trailing behind, and the recovery is hampered by challenges of recruitment and retention. And these are because educators, especially those who left when they were laid off, some of them ended up finding better paying jobs while they were still closed. And now to entice them back from an $18 an hour job to a $12 an hour job, I think it's a no-brainer. They will not come back because they need the job just to survive. So there are a lot of challenges. But what we also know was that the impact of COVID didn't affect everyone the same way within the childcare sector. I'm going to rely a lot on the finding from our California workforce study data, but this has been reported in other areas from other researchers. The theme is the same. There was a difference in program type. For example, family childcare providers were more likely to stay open compared to childcare centers. Family childcare providers, sometimes they are called home childcare providers. They really operate from their home and they look after fewer kids compared to childcare centers. And close to 8 in 10 family childcare programs remained open throughout the pandemic, and as compared to 3 in 10 childcare centers. But what is important to note is whether they were centers or family childcare providers, for those that stayed open, the reason they stayed open was because it was financially necessary in order to stay viable. They couldn't afford to close. And we know that educators put their lives at risk. Everybody else was staying home. They were going out there. And an important point to note was that resources, PPEs, cleaning, sanitization, and all the other supports were not readily available immediately to childcare workers. So they had to fend for themselves. Another important point we noticed was that the impact of COVID differed based on the funding source that the program had. What we noticed was that centers that received public funding, especially with contracts for Head Start or state preschool, fared much better. They had better access to PPE, they had better access to cleaning supports, and sometimes there were certain policies from the state that allowed them to, you know, get revenue better. For example, they were paid based on the actual certified need versus on the number of children who were actually attending. So you can imagine if you are paid based on your enrollment or licensed capacity, it's very different from when you are paid based on the number of kids who walk into the program. Because if tomorrow there are two or there's zero because the parents all kept them home, it means the revenue is zero. So these guys were able to do a little better because of this public sustained stable funding. They will also continue to pay their staff. Those centers that received public funding tended to pay their staff, even though the programs sometimes were closed. So we know that 3% of center directors with Head Start or state-funded contracts reported a furlough, compared to 13% of directors in programs that didn't have public funding. So there were significant differences in terms of where you get your source of funding, dictated how well you're going to react to the needs of your staff as well as to the needs of your program. We also know that COVID showed us the value of the stable public funding. I don't think I can overstate that. But the unfortunate bit is that those programs that have access to these stable sources of funding, the public funding, the contracts, they only represent just over a quarter of childcare centers in California, for example. There are even fewer family childcare providers who have access to the same, maybe close to 1 in 10. And so, which means, you know, we really have an under-invested, in terms of public dollars, childcare system that really seems to be sustaining the economy. So it is this big contradiction. And we also noticed that there were other educator demographics that dictated the impact of COVID. For example, we know that immigrant educators, educators of color, educators who were younger and unmarried or unpartnered reported experiencing more food insecurity. Some of them reported relying on food stamp. They worried more about being able to meet routine expenses. And I have to say, one of the most touching things that I noticed from the California data was that from those who responded, we actually had 8 individuals who said they experienced homelessness during the COVID pandemic. So, I mean, we have educators who have nowhere to live because they cannot afford a roof over their head. And the pandemic just made it worse because sometimes their hours were reduced or sometimes they actually lost their job. Some of them normally prior to the pandemic would have worked more than one job to be able to sustain themselves. So they have to have an extra job to subsidize the childcare job. But because of the pandemic and a lot of places got closed, they lost that second source of income. So you can imagine that not only are their hours being reduced or they are furloughed or they've been laid off in their childcare job, they don't even have the second job to fall back on. So behind these statistics, though, are human lives and families who have been materially impacted by COVID, and our institutional failures to protect those who were saving our families is just astounding. There is a very horrifying recent report that shows that childcare workers died from COVID at 2 times the rate of K-12 teachers, which really reflects the institutional failures to protect those workers, because childcare workers were leaving their homes to go into these spaces where they had to congregate. And those who work in childcare, and Annie can attest to that because she has been in a classroom. I haven't. But it is an emotional job. It is a job with high connections. It is a job at a time when everybody else was distancing themselves from everybody else. Childcare workers were moving towards people's children. So it is really sad when you listen to it. And when you read the direct quotes from early educators in our surveys, you hear their stories of housing, financial precarity, of sickness, of community resilience, and ways that they have found solutions to literally just survive the pandemic. You realize just how much we have failed them from a policy and from a human perspective. It is very touching, like having to analyze this information and put it together. It's in a way rewarding in the sense that it reveals what has always been brushed aside. And I think that is the power of data, to go back to the point about it is really important to invest in data systems that allow us to know what is going on with our workforce. And this one is a classic example, because the studies that have been conducted in response to the COVID pandemic have not only shown what we already know, but like even revealed things that sometimes we could never imagine. So, I mean, for me, what early educators did and the impact that COVID had on them just shows me what heroes they are. Everybody was banging pots for them. I hope people can continue banging pots for them now, even though the pandemic seems to be receding. We are only like one other little virus away from banging pots for them again, because they will step up. They will step up even though the systems are not supporting them adequately. So I think I'll leave it there for now.
Great. Thank you so much, Wanzi. What was the state of the childcare workforce before COVID?
Yeah, so I think Wanzi did such a great job of emphasizing how childcare workers, early childhood educators were in many ways heroes during the pandemic, but also they've always been heroes, right? And they were so before the pandemic. And so too, you know, the inequities we saw wrought out in COVID were there before as well. Just to name a few, we've been talking a lot about compensation, and this was a problem before COVID really drove it home. Pre-pandemic, 98% of all other workers earn more than childcare workers. So they're in the second percentile of wage work in the U.S. And based on 2019 data, this means that childcare workers are earning $11.65 an hour on average nationwide. And even within such a low-paid field, there are racial disparities. So for Black early educators, they make 78 cents less per hour on average than white peers. And there's an additional pay penalty for those who work with even younger children. So people who work with infants and toddlers make less on average than those working with 3 and 4-year-olds. There's very little access to health benefits, paid time off, retirement, and many early educators pre-pandemic as well shoulder substantial student debt. Besides the poor compensation, early educators experience poor working conditions. And we often say at the center that a teacher's work environment is the same as a child's learning environment. So we really need to be thinking about quality in terms of work environment and the effect that that can have on learning outcomes as well, but also for, you know, the educator at the heart of it. And so pre-pandemic research showed that Black and Latinx early educators in center-based settings were more likely than their peers to experience poor working conditions, which then undermined their well-being and their ability to implement effective practices. And of course, the pandemic heightened this. And finally, what we know from pre-pandemic is that there were childcare staffing shortages and issues with worker turnover. And of course, the pandemic exacerbated those and, you know, brought them out to a greater degree and made the consequences more visible. But those are not new problems to the sector. And again, we can point to the poor compensation and lack of stable funding.
Just to add to Annie's point there about the working conditions, we know that COVID stressed even those that were able to work from home. They were under a lot of stress. People who were able to work from home didn't have to go to the office. Early educators underwent burnout that even I think up to now, they are still trying to recover. And this is a sector that has very little support already. And yet they bore the brunt of all the emotional, the physical health stressors that were associated with COVID. And I don't know to what extent they have recovered, but just to stress the point that yes, the working environments are really important. And we know that even though we talked about the impact on wages and the impact on their economic well-being, there's also the impact on their emotional and psychological well-being as well.
So from our conversations, we know that the early childcare workforce is in this critical state since COVID has hit. So I'm wondering what relief is being offered to support the workforce and stabilize the sector now.
Yeah, thank you for this question, Ada, because I think it's so important to focus also on solutions because they are out there. You know, this isn't a crisis that some leaders aren't trying to solve. During COVID, you know, the Congress passed CARES and the American Rescue Plan, which offered some federal relief funds for childcare. And then some states are then using that money to really target the workforce and get relief funds to the educators. So at the center, when the American Rescue Plan first got passed in 2021, we released a set of recommendations for how to use these funds to prioritize the workforce. And, you know, now people often want to know, what are we seeing over a year later? And so what we're seeing is the most common ways that states are taking on compensation is either through sending direct relief payments to educators, members of the workforce. They did this, for example, in New Mexico, where they used CARES funding and then other relief funding to cut checks directly to individual educators. Another thing we're seeing quite commonly is through the ARPA or American Rescue Plan stabilization grants. And these grants go from a state to a program or provider, and states can require or incentivize an employer to use some of those funds specifically for their employees. So they might use it to increase an hourly wage or provide some kind of relief bonus. So for example, Minnesota requires 70% of the grant to the program to be then used for compensation or relief for staff. And, you know, the kinds of relief payments we're seeing, it's in the range of $200 to $1,000, and it may be one time or a couple times over a pay period. And not to diminish that this kind of relief payment could be extremely meaningful in the short term. We just don't want to confuse this relief response with meaningfully compensating someone over the course of their career, right? So there is this relief strategy that can happen, but there are state leaders that are laying the groundwork for meaningful compensation reform in a long-term way.
So you touched on some things that states are doing and some options for them as well. So kind of jumping off that, what are the most promising compensation policies and or strategies that states or even counties are using now? And what about the long-term solutions that you just touched on?
Right. So states are using the American Rescue Plan funds, but of course those will run out and they sunset. And given that there's not likely to be a transformational federal package, it's very disappointing. But we're really looking towards local leadership now on compensation. And one example of that that I want to highlight today is looking to DC, and they recently made huge strides in early educator compensation. They established an early childhood equity fund through a legislated local wealth tax. And then with that fund, they're cutting checks that are, you know, very substantial to educators of $10,000 to $14,000 in the next year as a relief measure. And then in the long term, they're using that fund to directly pay to providers who will then raise wages for their staff to comparability, or what we would call parity, with K through 8 educators. So this is a really great example of a locality that kind of took it upon themselves to generate local revenue and to create this kind of short-term relief program that is extremely meaningful, and then also a long-term compensation plan. I will also say that it's just so important that the framing of early education policies be centered in racial and gender equity, and this hasn't always been the case. So behind any successful policy, there's just the need to acknowledge how our country's history of racism, classism, and sexism all come together to shape our early care and education system, and then how we treat the workers implicated in it today. And so starting from this place as a strategy means we'll actually be talking about the root issues and the real cultural and political barriers to securing public funding for childcare to fund it like the public good that it is. Multiple opinion polls show that there's bipartisan support for public funding for childcare, but time after time, moderate Democrats and Republicans continuously block meaningful federal funding for childcare. Why do they do that? This is not distinct from what we're seeing with the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade. You know, the recent attack on reproductive and bodily autonomy that will most harm people of color and low-income people who have unwanted pregnancies in states with abortion bans, and forced pregnancy in a political environment that then also denies resources to care for that child and for those caregivers, families, educators around that child. These are not life-affirming politics. And these policies only further entrench political and economic power. So part of the long-term solution in childcare policy is also connecting the dots between these kinds of regressive and quite honestly violent policies, and then supporting the community-based political organizing that is pushing back.
And summed it up really, really well. And all I can say is that long-term solutions, we need stable public funding that guarantees quality jobs. And by quality jobs, we mean the wages and the benefits. Early childhood educators need benefits. One thing I can point out is that we did a recent report that shows that early childhood educators cannot afford to retire. For example, about 50% of center educators, both teachers and directors, only about 50% of them have retirement savings. It's even worse for teaching assistants and for family childcare providers, those ones who provide childcare from their homes. Only 1 in 5 family childcare providers said they had any retirement savings. About 40% of teaching assistants and aides said they had some form of retirement savings. Compare this to kindergarten teachers, where the majority, over 85% of them, close to 90%, have retirement savings. We know that they have retirement savings. So we need quality jobs. We need public funding that covers quality jobs and is allocated with equity aims. This means funding that covers quality jobs for the whole sector, regardless of what setting you are in, and addresses racial wage disparities so that we don't exacerbate racism and classism in the system because of the limited funding. I just wanted to stress that probably the reason why I kept banging on about the TK system and the potential it has for educators is the fact that the proposed pathway to a TK teaching job needs to be fair. We know that the majority of the early care workforce are women, and a substantial proportion of them are women of color. And we know that the situation is very different in the K-12 system. And if we only open the drawbridge that allows people who already are in better jobs in the K-12 system to have the opportunity to shift around depending on their career dreams and be able to teach in TK jobs, whilst making it so challenging for highly qualified people who are already teaching these 4-year-olds already prior to or during the implementation of a TK, it means we are not using the equity lens. We are not using the racial equity lens that says we know that a lot of these early educators that are already in the care system right now, the majority of them are women of color. They are highly qualified. They are very experienced. But if we make it very difficult for them to enter a TK classroom, it means the TK classroom will still reflect what is happening in the K-12, and they won't reflect the kids that they are looking after. And it's discriminatory in the sense that it is blocking them from potentially highly beneficial or high quality jobs that can provide them with a livelihood, so to speak. So anyways, I think that along with funding, states also need to invest in the comprehensive data system that ensure that they have the information they need to distribute resources equitably along the lines of addressing racial disparities and disparities caused by the different settings that educators find themselves in. So I think we cannot overstress the importance of adequate, sustained public funding and the data systems to support it.
That was Wanzi Muruvi, Senior Research and Policy Associate at CSCCE, and Annie Dade, CSCCE's Project Policy Analyst. The Center for the Study of Childcare Employment provides research and analysis on the preparation, working conditions, and compensation of the early care and education workforce. They develop policy solutions and create spaces for teaching, learning, and educator activism. CSCCE's vision is an effective public early care and education system that secures racial, gender, and economic justice for the women whose labor is the linchpin of stable, quality services. CSCCE, thank you so much for your work and for your contributions to the ProGov21 Policy Library. And as always, thank you to the Free Music Archive for providing our soundtrack. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Ada Inman, and this is the ProGov Podcast. We'll be back in August with a new episode discussing progressive local policy around energy, featuring the Northeast Energy Efficiency Partnerships. To keep up to date with ProGov21 in the meantime, you can follow us at ProGov21 on Twitter, sign up to receive our newsletter, and check out our constantly expanding, fully searchable online library of progressive policy resources at ProGov21.org.